Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Every Thursday is the day that you and I have the opportunity to learn from an expert. And today's expert is certainly quite the expert, having written many books, actually having a blog that has achieved over 7 million clicks. So, Dr. Susan Heitler, your work is important. It's out there, and people are absolutely being helped and encouraged by it. Thank you very much for joining us today on Mind Talk.
You are very welcome, and I appreciate your reminder that people really benefit. That keeps me going.
Well, you know, you've done so much already that you could actually stop and not do another thing, and I think people would still be extraordinarily encouraged and helped by all the work that you have done, but I know you're not going to stop, so
okay.
We don't even have to go there.
I'll believe you.
Okay. Today we are talking in more detail about the concept of anger. It is something that you address in your book, Prescriptions Without Pills, where you specifically note that this is a book that is designed to help folks get relief without pills from depression, anger, anxiety, and more. And anger is such a powerful, often misunderstood emotion for folks. So let's kind of start with what your definition of anger is, and tell us, is it a good thing, is it a bad thing, or is it just a thing?
Two great questions. First, what is anger? Anger is actually a chemical phenomenon within your body. When your body spurts out adrenaline, the emotion that you feel is what we label anger. Now, adrenaline is very important because it gives you extra energy to run fast, to sock someone in the nose if they're attacking you, or in some other body part, wherever necessary. It protects you.
I'm not even going to ask you about the other body part.
But let's move forward.
We're going to move forward, upward and onward,
right.
Literally. All right, so anger is something that, you know, under certain circumstances can certainly be very helpful.
Absolutely. And any animal, humans included, have a number one responsibility, which is to survive. And the number two is to protect the next generation so that the species can survive. For both of those, anger is very important. Picture a mother bear. If anything threatening comes along, she attacks.
And she attacks because that's her job, to protect her young.
Exactly. The difficulty with anger is sometimes we see a threat out there that could be handled in a more effective way than punching and attacking.
You know, I think about, as we delve more into the experience of anger today, I cannot help but think about the world in which we are currently living, which honestly seems kind of angry. Oh, wait, let me correct myself. Seems extremely angry on a regular basis. I mean, it's almost breathtaking, but perhaps that's just my view. What's your thought?
Well, we can look globally and we can look nationally, and I would agree with you on both accounts in certain places. The anger isn't pervasive. There are, though, some people, if we look globally, if you look in the Middle East right now, for instance, what's going on in Syria, in Iraq, where people are bombing each other and even bombing themselves, the anger turned inward, it's so sad because anger is a destructive. It's designed to protect us, but it's often, we think the best way to protect ourselves is to be aggressive. You know, the old saying, the best defense is a good offense. And when that's done on a national scale and by angry groups like initially Al-Qaeda and now ISIS and Boko Haram, these people are going around killing people all over. It's just so tragic for good people, of whom there are many who live in the Middle East. On the other hand, if the misuse of aggression, of anger, of attacking, is not limited to the Middle East. And so when we look at what's going on in America right now, it's also very disturbing. There are a lot of people who are angry enough that in both parties, they're choosing angry, attacking, critical leaders. Both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump share that people who are angry with things in their lives feel solace from hearing a politician or someone who says they're not a politician but is a politician who is expressing, verbalizing their anger and saying, we've got to change, because what's the point of anger? To motivate you to make a change of some sort.
So, again, we're talking about lots of different ways in which anger is showing up, not only in the world, but also in our local communities and in our homes. What are some of the costs of anger, if you will, in a personal relationship?
So, problem, a danger, a difficulty, or something you want that you're not getting. For instance, if you feel a spurt of anger when you're driving and someone's just cut in front of you, that anger tells you, oops, there's a danger there, and signals to you that they did something wrong. At the same time, if you act on anger impulsively rather than think about how to handle that, you could be in trouble. If someone just cut in front of you and you accelerate in order to teach them a lesson and bang into their rear end of their car, not a good idea.
So, again, there are actually literally physical, financial costs potentially to misplaced anger or anger that is acted out in an unhealthy way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. To some extent, you can measure the mental health of a person by the infrequency with which they act in anger. Again, that doesn't mean feelings of anger won't come up within them. They just pause for a moment, calm down, and figure out how to handle the situation. So healthy people sustain positive relationships, loving relationships, that are rarely tarnished by anger. Less healthy people overuse anger. And the saddest for me is parents who excessively get mad at their children. I say excessively because parenting is challenging. There are a lot of difficult situations that come up. 95, maybe 98% of those are handled in more effectively in other ways than in anger.
Again, we're talking about the various complexities of anger. It's almost like a tapestry. There are some threads that take you in a healthy direction and some threads not so much. You know, I think about people who are in chronically stressful situations, whether it's poverty or it's a war or it's an abusive relationship. Those folks, some of those folks actually sort of live in anger, and it feels like the only reaction they can have and perhaps the safest reaction they can have. What are your thoughts about those kind of chronic conditions that can lead people to chronically feeling angry and hostile towards their environment?
This is absolutely a problem. What we call stress means that your amygdala, the part of your brain that's a problem out there, is activated and telling your body to spread out adrenaline. That adrenaline can be put to various uses. It can lead you to worry excessively, just to keep worrying, to feel anxious. That adrenaline can lead you to feel angry. And if you then act on that angry by yelling at your children, criticizing your spouse, getting mad at yourself, that's really sad. And the more that people are stressed by difficult outside circumstances, like poverty, just not having enough money to pay the bills. I mean, you can be stressed financially without fitting in the category of low income. It's also many people, middle and upper income people, find themselves stressed financially about, gee, will I have enough money too? And any sense of stress, of anxiety that triggers your amygdala risks putting your body with too much adrenaline so that you fire off too quickly in anger. It's the classic example of somebody's had a hard time at work. They come home and they kick the dog or yell at the kids or bark at their spouse.
Let's talk about that individual who has had a terrible day at work, comes home and just sort of loses it in the household. Mm-hmm. Are there particular ways in which anger or distress can be expressed that might say to the individual or to family members, this is someone who is experiencing something beyond a situational blow up, and there really might be some psychological issues afoot here?
Right, both psychological or real issues, and those overlap. I'll give you the example of Joe, someone in my practice. Lovely fellow, very interesting. When he's relaxed, very fun, big, burly guy who is a truck driver. Now, truck drivers, actually, you might think that they're just sitting behind the wheel, looking at the scenery. It's more than that. It's a very stressful job, because truck drivers have to get from point A to point B in a very short period of time, often not enough time. So they're always on the edge of, will I make it, and should I risk breaking the law and driving additional hours? And it turns out to be quite stressful. So when he would come home, stressed from the pressure and also from not enough sleep, another fuel for anger, he would be likely to yell at the kids. He would be impatient with his wife. The good news is, you use the word, do they say something about it? That is the key. He actually sat down and had a real heart-to-heart talk with his wife. Now, he was a very private person and a very proud person. Joe didn't like to admit that he was having a hard time. So this was a big thing for him to actually say, you know, I can see I've been angry a lot at home, and I feel bad about it. So if he's barking at his wife and telling her what to do and demanding and critical, how much sympathy is she going to have? None. When he sat down with her and talked about himself, instead of bossing her around and criticizing the kids, then it was a whole different story. They had a really good talk. She began to understand for the first time all the pressure he was under at his current job, and they actually ended up with a resolution to the problem, with a plan of action. They agreed that he would quit his current truck driving job. He would hire on with a different company that pays less but puts less stress on their employees. And she agreed also that although she was doing a volunteer project that she loved, she would put that aside for the time being and take a paying job that would make up the difference between Joe's income in the stressful situation and what he would be able to earn in the new trucking company. Total change.
And such a lovely example of real teamwork between the two of them.
Once he stopped acting out his anger by shouting at everybody and instead started talking quietly about his problem, his feelings, his concerns. That's the switch between an abusive stance where your focus is pointing the finger at others and telling others what to do, and a stance that's healthy where your main job is to voice your thoughts, your concerns, and look at what you're doing and could do differently. It's a switch in focus that enabled him to handle his stress and anger in a new way and come out with solutions that would relax him and solve the problem.
I notice on your website, prescriptionswithoutpills.com, that you actually have a anger fuels list. And one of the things that you speak to is misplaced focus.
Yes. It's a phenomenon that therapists often don't talk about enough. Anytime a sentence begins with the word I, that means the focus is on yourself. I feel down today. I'm worried about, oh, now that's really good, because in addition to talking about yourself, you're verbalizing a feeling. By contrast, if it's you shouldn't have, you made me mad, only bad things come of that. You hurt the other person, and you're ineffective because in attacking others, you're losing sight of what's going on within you, and you lose your empowerment to do something about it.
But it's so much easier to blame somebody else.
Exactly. So one of the anger triggers is something that's not going well. Anything in your life.
Could be Monday morning. It's somebody else's fault.
Exactly. Could be that you're expecting dinner at 6 and here it is almost 7 and it's not ready.
Could be anything.
Could be anything, right.
Because all
of us have, from time to time in our lives, something that's unexpected or not what we thought what was going to happen, or that we just don't like. You know, it's your birthday and nobody noticed it. Or you thought you were going to get a raise at work and you've just been getting the same old paycheck. It's so many things happen that could be disappointing or frustrating. And then the question is, are you going to erupt in anger, looking at the them, the you, or are you going to look at yourself and be able to say quietly, I'm disturbed by this. I wonder what I can do to make changes.
Does it ever help, do you think, to look at anger as the flip side of hurt? And that, in fact, when you're angry, you're also hurt?
That is sometimes true, and sometimes you're scared. This is where I differ from a lot of therapists who say, anger is always an outgrowth of anxiety. For some people, it is an outgrowth either of feeling hurt or feeling anxious, or sometimes it's a way to feel stronger. That's why people bully. I want to feel strong, so I bully someone else. So the motivation can come from some areas, multiple areas. Sometimes there's a legitimate problem, and the anger comes from the sense that if you dominate over somebody, they'll do what you want. Like, kids, I told you 4 times already, it's time to come to the table for dinner, and you're still sitting there playing your game. The anger has come up because you're not getting something you want for the kids to come to the table to eat.
And I can see a particular child saying, yeah, that's right, I'm still playing my game.
Right.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk in a conversation with Dr. Susan Heitler, who is the author of many books, The Power of Two, Secrets to a Strong and Loving Marriage, The Power of Two Workbook, and the Prescriptions Without Pills is a book that we're taking a look at in some more detail today. So you stay right where you are. We are going to continue our conversation with Dr. Susan Heitler on the other side of this break. Dr. Heitler, in part, you are described as a clinical psychologist who specializes in the treatment of anxiety, depression, anger, narcissism, parenting challenges, and other marital difficulties. What does narcissism have to do with anger, depression, all these other things that you work with? Or is that a completely separate issue?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that, because narcissism is a word that's being tossed around lots these days. Of all my 200-plus blog posts on psychologytoday.com, the most common one that's had over a million hits is, "Are you a narcissist?" So it's on people's mind. So what exactly is and what is not narcissism? Narcissism often has anger as a component. At the same time, it's not the central feature of narcissism. At core, narcissism is inability to listen to other people and hear their points of view. And as a result, everything is all about me. Shall I give you an example?
Absolutely. I know there are many you could pull from.
But yes.
Absolutely.
I'll give you a starter example. You go with a group of friends to a restaurant, and one person is talking more than their share. So already that says something. Why does she need the spotlight all the time? What is that woman talking about? Herself. And then herself. And then herself. It's all about me. So that's right away a tip-off that there's narcissism. Now, why does that feed anger? Well, if you only see situations from your own point of view, then situations feel very annoying and you get mad. And if you don't have skills for talking and asking, well, what's another person's concerns, then when differences come up, there's no way to resolve it. If you can't hear their concerns, you can't build a win-win solution. I'll give you an example. A mother and an adult daughter are getting into a battle. The mother says, "Look, why don't you call me more often? And you don't come visit enough." She's really angry because it makes no sense that her daughter has abandoned her. She wants more attention, and her daughter just isn't giving that to her. Now, if she weren't so narcissistic, seeing it just from her point of view, she would see, number one, her daughter has two children, and they need attention. Number two, her daughter lives an hour and a half away. It's not so easy to just drive over. Number three, it's not very pleasant for her daughter when her daughter does drive over to visit her mom, because her mom tends to be negative and all about me. It gets boring to be listening to someone who's only talking about themselves. So that's how, when someone's narcissistic, only seeing things from their own point of view, they're prone to get angry.
Well, one would think that if that's the presentation for any number of individuals, wouldn't it be hard for them to be in relationships if their core relationship is just with themselves? How would they ever connect with anyone else?
This is a problem. This is very true. And it makes narcissistic people can be very difficult parents. So, for instance, I'm thinking of one fellow who, on the one hand, is so devoted to his young children. It's beautiful to see how much he cares about them. At the same time, when he wants them to eat the vegetarian diet that he prefers, and they just don't like that food, he gets furious. He can't see that their palate may be different from his. They may need a lot of carbohydrates, whereas he does fine with a mostly vegetable diet. So he gets furious at them because he can't see that they're different from him.
Well, let me ask you this. You're talking about a man and his children, but how does this person, and by the way, are women or men more or less likely to be diagnosed as narcissistic or having a narcissistic personality. But you know, the overarching question is, how does this person who's so involved with themselves ever find a way to have a spouse or a friend or anybody?
You're posing a tough one. First of all, they probably have a higher rate of divorce. At the same time, they probably have a higher rate of attracting partners. Now, why should that be? When someone's narcissistic, totally self-absorbed, they pay a lot of attention to their appearance. They often become very charming. They often earn a lot of money. And they may get a lot of power. They may be attracted to having lots of power. So those are four things that attract people of the opposite sex, whether you're male or female, being physically attractive, dressing beautifully, having a high position, being in politics, or being a football hero. All of those make you look very attractive. So initially, narcissists are more attractive than other people to new people who meet them. It's just over time that that begins to get old. So if the person said yes when the question, will you marry me, was proposed because, this guy looks like he's going to earn a lot of money, he'll be a good provider, he's handsome, he's probably good in bed, whatever, he's funny, he's fun, looks fine. The difficulty comes that over time, when you have a partner who really can't see or hear you, that gets old.
You know, it's interesting that you comment that the person is probably good in bed. And I think where some folks may get confused is that person indeed might be fabulous in bed, but not because of you, but because of what you bring to him or her in that experience.
Right. And so if we want to take a little divergence into sex here, being good at sex is a little like being good at sports. Some people have a real talent, and some people really focus time and energy on that. So in addition, let's say a man has focused a lot on sexuality and really prides himself on his sexuality. He's going to be very good at making this a good experience for the woman, because the more excited and sexually involved the woman is, the more exciting it is for the man. So there's a case where their interests dovetail and the sexual relationship may be very positive.
And again, positive not for the reasons that he or she, the other partner may assume is the reason, but really to feed one's own self.
Because being sexually effective, the answer is yes. It makes it a more gratifying activity for him. Just like a good athlete learns, let's take a football player, he learns to keep his eye on where the receiver is down the field. He's not just looking at what he himself is doing if he's the quarterback. He has to be very attuned to his players because that's how he can score touchdowns. Now, that can be done in a narcissistic way. It's still all about me and how many touchdown passes I throw. Or it can be as part of a team and attending to what is good for everyone on the team. And it's a subtle difference, but it's a huge difference.
For those people who are listening right now, and maybe they're thinking, you know what, I think I'm involved with a narcissistic boss, a narcissistic parent, somebody who's narcissistic in my life. And actually, the more I hear Dr. Heitler talk about this, the angrier I get. So now they're angry. So now what do we do?
Okay. So the anger is there to tell, again, a great question. I'm very impressed. The anger is there to tell you something's askew. If you act in anger, though, towards someone who's narcissistic, what do you think you'll get back? More anger.
Right.
Not a good direction to go, because narcissistic people tend not to be very open to feedback about what they're doing wrong, because an inner part of them is quite fragile and just hates hearing it. they treasure the idea that I'm always right and I'm a great person. If there's any problem, it's you. So if you're involved with someone like that, better to calm down, let your anger tell you there's a problem, but then let your brain figure out for you what's a good way to approach this. So there are marriages with narcissistic people that work very well. Shall I give you an example?
Please do. Absolutely.
Yes. One of the most extreme narcissistic, self-absorbed, and also highly successful business people, I won't say the most because I've seen a lot of couples like this in my practice, where he's highly successful and highly all about me, and she's realizing, after all, she lives in a marriage where she doesn't really have a partner. She does have someone who provides social status and money, and she doesn't have someone who's really a partner. So I'm thinking of one woman in particular who said, you know, he is how he is. It's like a handicap for him. It's not really something he's doing on purpose. He really can't pick up or hear anything that's going on with me. So I'm going to be very judicious, careful in when I try to tell him something about me. And the rest of the time, I'll accept he is who he is. I'll enjoy the things that are fun to do with him, like going skiing or going to football games or going camping. Those are things I love to do and he loves to do. So when we're doing activities, we're fine. If I want to talk with him about a problem I'm having at work, forget it. I need to have a good girlfriend to talk with. If I want more help with the kids at home, forget it. I have to get the older kids to help more with household chores and with the younger kids because my husband is just not able to pitch in unless I praise him hugely. And that's the other part of living with a narcissist. Praise and compliments and attention will get you everywhere.
Interesting.
They thrive on that.
Now, you've said a couple of words that people don't often attach to their experiences of what they see as a narcissistic person. You've said that that narcissistic person is fragile, and that's not how he or she presents himself. And you've also said that person is not able. Again, not how he or she presents himself or would like to be seen. So can you explain how narcissism might begin to occur, particularly for those people who are saying, well, this is just a bum and a terrible bum and I'm just done. Is there a way to understand and have compassion for that narcissistic person?
This is a question that also has interested me a lot because I believe in marriage and there are often a lot of good aspects to being married to someone who's narcissistic. So I've really paid attention to how a spouse of someone who's narcissistic, if the spouse wants to stay, can still have a good life and have it work out well. So what I've come to is that narcissism is the last stop on the train before the train goes into the realm of autistic spectrum disorders. Now, that may sound like a stretch, and I offend a lot of people when I say that. I still think it's true. So what do I mean by that? The highest functioning end or side of autistic spectrum disorders are people who have Asperger's. A characteristic of Asperger's is they have what's called cognitive rigidity. They get an idea and then they can't see from another person's point of view that there's another way of looking at that situation. So if they get the idea that we need to hang curtains in the living room, once they're stuck on that, they can't switch to thinking, maybe it would be a good idea to just get shades. They're just stuck on curtains. So narcissistic people share with Asperger's people a tendency to believe their way of seeing things is the only way and to have trouble seeing things from other people's point of view. That's why they are described as not having empathy, is they just can't listen to the other person. So if the other person, their spouse, say, says, gee, I'm feeling so sad, not only do they not understand that that's about her, not about them, they take it personally. They do what's called personalizing. They think that she is saying, oh, I'm doing something that's making you sad. So in any case, this border between narcissism and Asperger's is a fuzzy boundary, because both of them have that inability to hear things from the other person's point of view and to take in others' perspectives.
You know, that's really fascinating. I could probably veer off and talk to you about that for an hour, but I'm not going to. So, you know, you may have to come back, because that really is an interesting and fascinating look at the similarities between those two diagnostic categories. And I don't think a lot of people talk about that potential.
You're right. I've written a blog post on that, and I get some angry letters back, and mostly I get comments, oh, I see now. I've always had a hunch that my narcissistic son, husband, daughter, whatever, is similar to her grandfather and her uncle and or her grandmother. It's not all male. So that says to me there's a genetic component, and that's helped me to be more sympathetic with the inability to move beyond self. The other way I look at it sympathetically is it's like a developmental delay. And I say delay because people who are narcissistic but on the healthier side often can learn, just like somebody who's not athletic can learn to ride a bike and throw a ball. It just takes more active teaching and practice. So if there's a developmental delay in developing the skills about hearing others, that's like the difference between a three-year-old. Three-year-olds are naturally all about me. I'm thinking of my three-year-old granddaughter who wanted her mom's attention right away when her mom and I were talking on the phone. That little girl's 10-year-old sister, who can see mom's talking on the phone, I'll wait just a couple minutes and then I'll talk with her.
So, you know, the good news, I guess, that I'm hearing, because a lot of people think once you have a diagnosis, that's your diagnosis for life. And you're saying there are some categories where there can be some learning and some sort of reconnecting of the dots that
exactly.
can help to be a shift. Okay. Dr. Heitler, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to continue to talk along the issue of anger and how it shows up with perhaps someone who's identified as borderline or paranoid or
Great.
Even bipolar. We'll be right back. Folks,
Great.
This is Pamela Brewer. Don't go away. We're coming back to really interesting conversation. Dr. Heitler, there has long been lots of misunderstanding about the diagnostic category of borderline, with, as you know, people thinking, ranging it means from borderline psychotic to, I don't know, a fashion statement. So what is your description of what it means to be an individual with a borderline personality?
Yes, you are absolutely right that there is huge confusion, and the word is used in many different ways, as is the word narcissist. There's a core brain issue in each of these diagnostic categories, and then a whole lot of additional labels that get socked on because they sometimes co-occur. So borderline individuals have a hyperactive amygdala. That is, they see danger where there's no danger. It's like a smoke detector where if a mosquito flies by, all of a sudden the alarms go off. The amygdala that's set too sensitively also goes off with an alarm that says, this is a 10-alarm fire, when it's really just a little campfire. So that to me, and to many researchers in the field now, is the core ingredient of borderline personality disorder.
So give us an example as to what that looks like in a human being.
Okay. I've written about, is your mother a borderline, have a borderline personality? And then I've had floods of letters from people who grew up with a borderline mother. Now, I do want to highlight in this response to something you said earlier in today's dialogue, are there differences in male and female diagnoses? Often when men have a hyperactive amygdala, they're labeled either narcissists, or they're labeled bipolar, or they're labeled abusive. Many men who are so aggressive that they end up in jail actually have a borderline personality disorder. In women, it comes out as more often as verbal violence. So they may rage at their children, rage at their spouse, rage at their own aging mother, or rage at their children. But with borderline personalities, raging is the characteristic feature. So when I've written about children of borderline parents or adult children of borderline parents, what they write is about having been raged at incessantly as children and inappropriately. It's not that they did something, they just got raged at.
So how does that ultimately affect that young child growing up? I mean, I would think that growing up into adulthood,
devastating.
So what do they learn to do with anger?
So there have been studies of children of parents who are abusive, and this is true whether it's verbal abuse or physical abuse. They become very conforming, very eager to please, so they make great employees. At the same time, at the core, they're extremely sensitive. They're frightened of people because they're anticipating there's going to be rage at any moment. Often these people end up not getting married because they're just terrified of being close to people. And the saddest thing is often they repeat what was done to them, because just like if you grew up in a place where they speak French, you speak French naturally. You didn't have to go to French classes. If you grew up where the language of interaction was rage, you're at risk for raging to your own family members.
It sounds like there are many things that can lead to one having a unhealthy experience of anger and having real challenges in terms of how to deal with it. You mentioned a potential diagnosis of bipolar. Where does that fit in this conversation?
So bipolar, another radically overused term, means that somebody's emotions become hyper intense. It may mean that they're always somewhat hypomanic. The intensity can come either as a manic episode, too much energy, or as a depressive episode, just no energy for doing things. When people are depressed, they tend to be angry, but at themselves. That's the depressive end of the bipolar, or the depressive part of the cycle. When they're manic, we think of manic as being hyper-happy. Sometimes that's true, and that's part of the picture. Hyper enthusiastic, going out, having sexual interactions with people all over, thinking they're just king of the world. The other part of the manic, though, is a very much of a quickness to anger. So bipolar people, when they're in the manic or hypo, a little less than manic phases, are very quick to anger.
You know, it just all sounds like there are so many potentials for having difficulties with anger and anxiety and all of these issues. And yet, you have written a book that's entitled Prescriptions Without Pills. And I got to say, for folks who have anger issues, very often, you know, I mean, it's part of our language, right? Go take a pill, calm down.
Right. So when a person has one of these more serious issues, including with anger and with depression and with severe anxiety, that's when medications can be a great blessing. People with bipolar disorder who take their medication can often function very normally. So when I wrote Prescriptions Without Pills, the goal is not to disparage pill taking, but to disparage excessive use and inappropriate use of psychological medications. Because the more mild depression, anger, anxiety that we all feel from time to time, too often is being responded to by taking pills.
Well, let's talk about one of those non-pill prescriptions that you describe. Let's talk about the hand map. Explain that, if you would.
Mm-hmm. So if you put your hand out in front of you, you will see that as you're walking, start up around your elbow and run your fingers down your hand. Oh, that's like walking down the road. Excuse me, run them down from your elbow toward your wrist. That's walking down the road of life. But then as you hit the wrist, you hit a bump. What's the bump? It's a situation that's challenging. There's a conflict, there's an issue, there's a problem, there's a decision to be made. At that bump point, there's five pathways you can take. If you have good skills for addressing problems, listening to all aspects of it, to what other people have to say, to your own concerns, and then you ask yourself, okay, what can I do to make this better? That's the road that leads to well-being. Let's make that be your thumb. And picture your thumb leading up into the realm of well-being. Now, there's four fingers that are pointing in a different direction. Those four fingers stand for anger, depression, anxiety, and addictions. Why is that? Because they're the four roots of response to a situation that lead you to feeling worse instead of to well-being. That's depression, when you fold, just give up on what you want. That's feeling like you just lost. The second root is anger, mobilizing to fight, to get mad, and to get what you want by dominating or hurting the other. The third finger was anxiety. That's the freeze response, where instead of trying to solve the problem by gathering more information, you just get stuck. So the situation keeps hovering, and you continue to feel anxious about it. The fourth root is a flee reaction. Just stop off at the liquor store and drown yourself in drinks so you're no longer aware of. You successfully took a flee route away from even remembering that you have a problem. And that could be any of the addictions, any drugs, eating disorders, compulsive habits of any type, sitting and playing games on the computer all the time, can be escape from facing real difficult situations in your life. That's the hand map.
All right. So, in fact, what I have in front of me is a reminder that there are five potential pathways that I can access to respond to my problems. I can either fold, feel powerless. I can fight, which means I get angry. I can freeze, so I just kind of get stuck there and get anxious.
Like a deer in headlights.
Like a deer in the headlights, literally. I can flee to drugs, alcohol, excessive anything.
Right.
Or I can take that thumb that's sticking up, that find the solutions road, which ultimately I would suggest helps to soothe those other potential issues. I'm looking at these other four fingers, and now that my find solutions path is really in front of me, you know, the others are kind of more relaxed and they don't have to take center stage because I'm focused on finding a solution.
Exactly. And a perfect example of that is Joe, the truck driver that we talked about at the beginning of the program. When he sat down, talked with his wife, really looked at his situation and found a solution. Together they found a solution. Wow. Their whole household and he personally became happy campers.
Really not a bad solution. And again, it speaks to the almost urgency of being able to have a conversation with yourself.
Absolutely.
And with
Absolutely.
The other people around you. And I would suggest that even in today's world, we don't pay enough attention to the value of communications with self as well as others.
Absolutely.
So let's shift for a moment to the issue of well-being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've looked at our map, we've made a decision, we've got some beginning understanding of, you know, different kinds of diagnostic categories. So now I'm looking at well-being, and I want to know what that means. Because, you know what, I'm thinking maybe well-being is 8 pounds of chocolate and 12 bottles of champagne.
Right. So well-being has short-term and long-term pieces. You feel great when you're eating that chocolate, and not so great when you step on the scale.
Gotcha.
Right. So then what's a formula for long-term contentment? I'm actually working on 10 tips for sustaining well-being that people can get for free if they go to my website with the same name as the book, PrescriptionsWithoutPills.com.
Okay.
So I'll be listing 10 characteristics of people who successfully live in the world of well-being.
Let's have a couple right now.
One is you need to have a project. Now, that's because even animals, when they're pursuing prey, feel an increase in dopamine, a happy chemical that they share with adults. So anytime you have a project, a focus for your energies, you're going to feel better. So that project can be learning yoga. It can be earning money. It can be something that helps other people. Any project, it can be art. It can be athletic. Anytime you have a project where you're trying to get better or trying to do or accomplish something, pursuit of that end stimulates the flow of dopamine, and you'll feel good. That's one piece.
Interesting. What's another piece?
Another piece is people feel good from oxytocin. Oxytocin is the chemistry of bonding. So anytime you're laughing with people, talking with people, looking eye to eye, touching skin to skin, feeling connected, even going to the grocery store and talking with the clerk who rings up your order stimulates a spurt of oxytocin, of bonding. So learning how to sustain good relationships makes your whole life feel more well-being.
And so it actually sounds like laughter really can be something of a happy cure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a natural antidepressant. Want one more?
I'll take it.
Okay. This is springtime and summer. When people are outdoors and experiencing greenery, feeling the sunshine, both green and sunshine stimulate positive body chemistry and give you a sense of well-being.
So what I'm hearing in all of these examples is that a sense of well-being, of good regard, doesn't have to cost you any money. I mean, these
Absolutely.
Are all things you can naturally sort of access in the world around you.
Absolutely. Now, people, for instance, love to take vacations. Why do they like vacations? New is stimulating. And also, being in a mode that's more relaxed and less stressed is stimulating of well-being feelings. At the same time, vacations don't have to be expensive. Vacations can be, for instance, my husband and I, every Sunday afternoon, take a vacation by going for a walk in a part of our city, Denver, where we've never been before. It gives us the feeling of new. It gives us the camaraderie, the bonding, the oxytocin of being together, especially with someone one cares about. These are invigorating and stimulating of all the good body chemistry. And also, we have a project which is getting to know our city and the towns around it. So that gives dopamine, oxytocin, just all these good feeling chemicals.
So again, you can experience all of this, and you don't have to spend a fortune, and you don't have to hop on a plane or a train.
Exactly.
The idea that we can ourselves have such a positive impact on changing the way we experience our world is, and doing it often without medication. As you've said before, there are certainly times when medication is indicated and very helpful, but often you don't have to. I think that's such a hopeful, reassuring, reaffirming lesson for so many people.
Yes, as a matter of fact, one of the most potent antidepressants costs no money and requires no pills, and that's gratitude, or in fact, any positive stance toward yourself, towards others, towards your world. Appreciation, compliments, even agreeing, all those positive stance, and especially gratitude. Thank you. Whether it's to a higher power or to your neighbor or to your children, to your spouse. The more you express positivity, the more well-being you experience. And the more well-being and sunshine you communicate to the others around you.
And I have to express a great deal of gratitude to you for joining us here on Mind Talk. It is always a delight and a lovely learning experience to talk to you. Thank you so much, Dr. Susan Heitler, author of several books, but in particular, Prescriptions Without Pills for Relief from Depression, Anger, Anxiety, and More. Thank you, Dr. Heitler.
You are so welcome, and thank you for inviting me and for being such a great interviewer.
I accept that. Thank you. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you on a daily basis as an educational public service. It is not intended to take the place of any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That's pamela@mindtalk.org. You can give me a call at 301-654-5286. And folks, I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, then that's exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.